Welcome to the My Buddy Green podcast. I'm Jason Wachob, founder and co-CEO of My Buddy Green, and your host. This week's show is sponsored by our best-selling Sleep Support Plus supplement. Our science-backed formula helps you fall asleep faster, stay asleep longer, and wake up feeling rejuvenated. Look, I never knew how good sleep could be until I started taking our product. Now it is a non-negotiable for Colleen and I as we take it every single night. So now's the time to upgrade your sleep. Just go to mybuddygreen.com/sleep25 and use the code sleep25 for 25% off your first month's subscription. Sweet dreams and enjoy the show.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Sleep. We all do it, but very few of us sleep exceptionally well, which is why we have Dr. Jade Wu on the show to help you achieve the best night's sleep of your life. Even if you don't really suffer from a sleep issue, I bet you never knew sleep could be so good. Jade is a board-certified behavioral sleep medicine specialist who completed her PhD at Boston University and her medical psychology residency and clinical fellowship at Duke University School of Medicine. Her research focuses on treating sleep disorders in those with chronic illness, and she also serves as a reviewer for top-tier scientific journals. And in today's episode, Jade drops her knowledge on how to solve every sleep issue, like insomnia, sleep deprivation, sleep apnea, which more people have than you know, and more. Plus, her must-have tips for proper sleep hygiene and common sleep myths you need to know. So in terms of setting ourselves up for a good night's sleep, I tend to think of, you know, getting some morning sunlight, having a caffeine cutoff time, turning off electronics, not watching disturbing TV like the evening news, sleeping in a dark and cool room, having at least a 3-hour gap between dinner and bedtime, also not having a huge meal at bedtime, limiting alcohol. Those are some of the basic fundamentals that immediately come to mind and I think our audience is familiar with. What else are we missing?
Well, I think that's a really good start. I think those are what we can consider sleep hygiene tips, similar to dental hygiene tips. Like, yes, as a basic foundational set, we should all like floss and brush, right? That's all good. And that helps to maybe prevent problems from happening. But if you already have a cavity, then flossing and brushing is not enough, right? So sleep hygiene, similarly, is great as sort of a preventative foundational set of things you do, but is not enough if you already have sleep problems. So would you like to talk about specific sleep problems or more like...
I think that's an important point, and that hygiene is great if you have a decent baseline and will help a lot of people. But the fact that 70 million Americans suffer from sleep issues, and they disproportionately affect women. I think women are 40% more likely to experience sleep difficulties. Feels like that hygiene is only going to go so far.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what else? Let's get into it.
Yeah. So first of all, I'm glad you mentioned the gender disparity. So it's specifically insomnia that women have more of. Women are about a time and a half as likely to have insomnia compared to men, but men are much more likely to have sleep apnea, about 3 times as likely. So it depends on the sleep disorder that we're talking about when it comes to gender disparities.
Can you talk about specifically the difference for people, apnea versus insomnia?
Sure, yes. So sleep apnea is actually a breathing disorder. So it happens during sleep, but it's when people their airways are blocked temporarily for you know, up to 10 seconds or even longer. And because your oxygen saturation in your blood is going down, down, down during that whole time you're not breathing, it's forcing your brain to wake you up in order to breathe. So every time that happens, which happens every couple of minutes, few minutes throughout the whole night, your sleep is interrupted. So people with sleep apnea are really putting, first of all, a big burden on their heart because of the oxygen desaturation and all of that, but also on their sleep and their brain functioning because they basically don't get into deep sleep at all. And whatever other sleep they're getting is also interrupted.
So how would that show up on one's, you know, I wear an Oura ring. Would that show up as, you know, blood oxygen dropping? Would that show up in a high resting heart rate or a very low deep sleep? How would that show? How does someone know?
Well, you don't need an Oura ring to know. So if you snore a lot or snore loudly.
Well, then I go, if you're not sleeping with a partner, that's another one. Do you know if you're snoring, if you're asleep?
Well, there's an app for that. It's called SnoreLab, and it records you while you sleep, and it actually quantifies how much snoring you do. So not everyone who snores has sleep apnea, but a lot of people who snore do have sleep apnea. And if you have sleep apnea, you probably snore. And also another telltale sign is being very sleepy during the day. So this is like you fall asleep during really boring lectures. You fall asleep at red lights. You know, you fall asleep while watching TV in the evening. I mean, it doesn't, by the time you're falling asleep while on the road driving, that means you're way far gone. Even well before that, you might have sleep apnea if you feel really, really sleepy when you sit down, lie down during the day.
So would it show up though on an Oura for those who wear Oura rings like myself in terms of oxygen saturation or?
Yeah, potentially. I'm not sure how accurate Oura rings specifically are for detecting sleep apnea, but potentially you could see oxygen saturation going down during the night, heart rate and heart rate variability being higher at night, heart rate variability being lower throughout the day and night. But I wouldn't necessarily count on those indices to look for sleep apnea. You may have sleep apnea without having a significant difference on those indices, especially on an Oura ring or other consumer tracking device. So I would say err on the side of getting tested for sleep apnea if you suspect you might have it, like you snore or you're sleepy during the day, or you know, you feel really sluggish during the day. It's worth checking it out, especially if you're a middle-aged male or older. The rates of sleep apnea are just astounding.
Is it just, so what percentage of the population, if you had to guess, if you're a middle-aged male?
Middle-aged male, like 40%.
Wow.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And is there another test beyond the snoring test besides going into a lab?
It would pretty much take going to the way that your primary care doctor would screen you for sleep apnea is using the Stop Bang checklist. So it's an acronym of 8 items. Stop Bang stands for snoring, tired, observed apnea. So if you or your partner see you stop breathing or gasp during the night. P is high blood pressure. B is BMI, so BMI over 30, which is not a very, you know, high threshold. A is, oh my gosh, what is A? We'll come back to A because I don't remember what that is for the moment. N is neck circumference. So someone with a thicker neck, I don't know how useful like a cutoff is because we don't really know the numbers for our circumference for our necks. But if it kind of looks like you have a more recessed chin or a stronger neck, that may be a higher chance for sleep apnea. And G is for gender, but really more accurately, it's sex. So male sex.
Got it. And so insomnia, more likely to impact women. If middle-aged men are 40% on the apnea, what's the percentage, if you had to guess, on women and insomnia?
I would say 15 to 20%.
Wow.
Yeah. The overall prevalence of insomnia in the overall population is like 10 to 15%. For women, it's higher than that. So insomnia is when you have trouble falling asleep, trouble staying asleep, or just having really poor feeling like you're having poor quality sleep, you're not well rested. So insomnia, importantly, it's not the same thing as sleep deprivation or insufficient sleep. So often people get those two mixed up. You know, we always say, oh, we're such a sleep deprived society, we don't get enough sleep. That's not the same thing as insomnia, because insomnia is when you have plenty of opportunity to sleep. You know, you have the 8 hours, 9 hours in bed, but you're having trouble falling asleep, or you're awake for a long time during the night. Whereas sleep deprivation is you don't have enough opportunity to sleep. So this is like the single mom working three jobs, or the student that's pulling an all-nighter to study, or people working shift work and they just don't have enough time to sleep. So the two are very different.
What's the biggest hurdle there for that group? Is it falling asleep or staying asleep? Or is it typically a combination of both for someone who suffers from insomnia?
It can be either or both. For younger folks, I tend to see more trouble falling asleep. For middle-aged and older folks, it tends to be more trouble staying asleep or just being awake for a long time during the night, or waking up too early in the morning.
And so for this group specifically, there's two different issues. And again, sleep hygiene is only going to get us so far, and it's probably not working effectively for this group. So what should folks do who have trouble falling asleep beyond sleep hygiene? Let's start with them first.
Sure. So the gold standard treatment is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, so CBTI. And so fun fact, in our clinical trials testing CBTI, we use sleep hygiene as the control condition. So sleep hygiene is literally the placebo. It's like the sugar pill equivalent. So we know it does not work for people with insomnia. So what does work instead in CBTI is, the way I like to think about CBTI is it's resetting your relationship with sleep. So people with insomnia tend to have a really strained relationship with sleep. They think about it a lot. They think about sleep and they work really hard at sleeping. And, you know, they try every which way to fall asleep or to stay asleep, and it just doesn't work. Or maybe it works for a couple of nights and then it doesn't work again. And then they try different medications. They try to get off of medications, but they feel like they can't. So they're working really hard at it, but they're not treating sleep like a friend. They're treating sleep like an engineering problem or like a chore. And when you have a strained relationship with sleep, when you're not being friends with sleep, then sleep is going to run away from you. Sleep is not one of those things where the harder you work, the better you get at it. It's kind of the opposite. Because, you know, if you ask any really good sleeper, well, how do you do it? How do you achieve good sleep? How do you fall asleep so easily? They're not going to have, like, you know, a list of really good tips for you. They're just going to say, well, I don't know, I just do, right? It's so effortless, as it should be. So cognitive behavioral therapy is all about resetting your relationship with sleep so it becomes effortless again. And so that means setting up some parameters to help, you know, to help your sleep stay on track, but then letting everything else go. Just like in a good human relationship, you have some boundaries that are good for the relationship, and then everything else is like, go with the flow and, you know, a mutual sort of back and forth. So for example, we don't want to go to bed too early when we have insomnia. A lot of people who have insomnia try to make up for what they perceive as lost sleep by going to bed really early to catch up. But this actually just backfires because you don't have enough sleep drive saved up yet. You don't have enough sleep appetite saved up. So if you're going to bed early, you're just going to struggle. You're just going to be awake, tossing and turning. And the more you're awake and tossing and turning and frustrated, the more you're learning that sleep is a frustrating thing and your bed is an anxiety-producing place. And then the next time you get into bed, what's your brain going to do? Your brain's going to say, oh, I know what this place is. This is where we struggle and get frustrated and get anxious. Don't worry, let me get that program fired up for you right away. You're welcome. So your brain is trying to anticipate what's going to happen when you get into bed. And hopefully what it's anticipating is relaxation and sleepiness, not anxiety and frustration. So for people who are having trouble falling asleep, I would say one of the quickest ways to reset, it's just to go to bed later when you're actually really sleepy and make sure your body actually has a chance to feel that sleepiness by having a relaxing wind down routine.
I love that. What else?
Well, if we want to move on to people who have trouble staying asleep, similar philosophy here. If you wake up in the night and you're starting to toss and turn, it's been more than a few minutes, you're starting to get frustrated. I mean, what would you say is the best thing to do in that scenario?
Well, a couple things, but I'm like cheating because I kind of know the answer. Don't stay in bed, get out of bed. A hack I've heard we've had on this show is put your head in the freezer.
I don't think that's necessary, but sure.
but get out of bed for a moment and then get back in. You should not turn on your phone. You should not turn on your TV, but like take a moment to reset.
So if I may push back on that a little bit.
Please do.
I would say for the average person who occasionally has a longer time awake during the night, everything you said sounds fine to me. Like, sure. And the freezer thing, I don't think the temperature change is going to be strong. It's going to have strong enough an effect where it overrides the amount of effort you're putting in. Because what we call sleep effort, anything you're doing to try really hard to get to sleep is going to put more of a spotlight on the fact that you're not sleeping and put more pressure on yourself to get to sleep. So I think any of these hacks, like putting your head in the freezer, is only going to ramp up the sleep effort enough that it might override any benefit from the temperature change. But I mean, that's just my opinion.
I'm botching the science. There was something to do with the physiological response, which I'm botching the science on. It was from Eric Prather from UCSF. And we'll link to it in the show notes. He had a more eloquent and detailed response as to why the freezer could work rather than my just put your head in a freezer. We'll put that in the show notes and we'll move on.
Sure. So I would say, yes, physiological response is real, but if you have insomnia already, any little tip or trick like that is not going to be enough, because your problem as someone with insomnia is that you're trying too hard. So instead of trying so hard and saying, okay, these are the steps I need to follow, and these are the things I need to avoid. And, you know, I even have insomnia patients who say, like, I barely open my eyes. I try to keep my eyes as closed as possible. And like, I don't turn on any lights. And I just kind of crawl my way to the bathroom and like lay on the bathroom floor on the cold tile there. And I'm like, okay, you're trying way too hard. What you need to do is just stop trying to sleep. Whatever you're doing to try to sleep, whether it's counting sheep or going in the freezer or meditating or whatever it is, stop that. You're trying too hard. You need to just switch gears and just do something enjoyable. So whether that's reading a book, folding your laundry, watching TV is fine. Pulling out your phone is fine. Any of that is going to give you less stimulation than what you were doing before, which is trying really hard to sleep when you have insomnia.
So it feels like performance anxiety is a huge driver for those who suffer from insomnia. And my guess is it carries over to, this doesn't just happen at night. It's probably throughout one person's life. They work hard, they perform, they set goals, they achieve goals. And this becomes a real point of stress in someone's life. And I understand how that can kind of take it over and you get more frustrated and you want to work harder because it works in every other aspect of your life.
Exactly. It sure does. But it doesn't work here. Actually, a good analogy I have, and you know, this is not going to apply to the women listeners, but erectile dysfunction. The harder you're trying in the moment, the more pressure you're putting on yourself to perform. And the more it doesn't work.
Well, on that note, building off of that, in your research, because I want to talk more about your research on cognitive behavioral therapy here, is you found an improvement, because this is erectile dysfunction ladders to cardiovascular disease, that it may lead to an improvement in hypertension and other cardiovascular outcomes. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, so that's a study that I'm working on at Duke University School of Medicine right now with my colleagues here. And the idea is, so your blood pressure should follow a day-to-night pattern. So it should be higher during the day and lower at night. So we call this blood pressure dipping at night. And so it should dip at least 10%. Now, what we see in a lot of folks with hypertension is that not only is their blood pressure high in general, it doesn't dip at night. So we're wondering why. And by the way, the subsection of people who have hypertension whose blood pressure doesn't dip at least 10% at night, they have the worst outcomes. So we really want to make this dipping happen. And so one hypothesis we had is, well, could it be that some of these folks are just not sleeping well enough to allow their body to relax and for their autonomic system, their physiological systems to come down at night as it should? So what we're doing is taking folks with insomnia and higher elevated blood pressure, and we're giving them cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia to try to improve their sleep and seeing if their blood pressure improves, and specifically whether the dipping improves at night.
My sense is you're going to see a dramatic improvement.
I hope so. Yeah, we're right at the tail end of recruiting participants, so we can't look at the data yet because we can't bias ourselves while we're still recruiting participants and putting them through the assessments. But in about 2 months, we'll be done with recruitment and assessments, and we'll be able to unveil the analysis.
So if someone's listening and says, I want to be part of this, is there a link? Can we provide info so someone can reach out?
Yes, I can give you that link and it can be in the show notes. But they have to be in the Raleigh-Durham area because we do in-person assessments.
I'm sure we'll have people who would fly there. If you're struggling, here's the thing. If you're struggling from insomnia, what's so unfortunate is people have tried everything. And I think if this is, and there's a downstream effect that affects everything. It affects your cardiovascular health. It affects, you know, there's a great line, like, ask someone, if you want to know how someone's doing today, ask how they slept last night. It affects your quality of life, your happiness, your health, your desire to exercise, everything. So I think a lot of people will raise their hands for this.
Absolutely. A lot of my patients say, oh, if only I slept better, I would be able to go to the gym again, which I really liked to do before, or I would be able to enjoy playing with my kids more. And so, yeah, sleep absolutely touches on every aspect of your health and well-being.
And so another, you know, as we think about the two different groups, those who suffer from sleep apnea and those who suffer from insomnia, I'm curious your view on napping. Positive or negative for these people?
Oh, yes. Such a great question. And funny enough, I actually just recorded my first Audible original lecture series. It's all about napping, and that's coming out soon. So keep an eye on that. It's like 2.5 hours of me talking about the science of napping. So there's a lot of detail I could go into.
Awesome. We'll link to it.
Yeah. But for now, let's just say napping could be a double-edged sword. So nap responsibly. So it could be a real boon for people who are not getting enough sleep at night. So especially for, you know, tired parents and shift workers or students who don't get enough time to sleep at night, napping could be a lifesaver. And I love napping. I think napping is just such a fabulous, you know, like an elixir of life that we get to have in the middle of the day if we want to have it. But when it comes to people with insomnia, it could be potentially a good thing or a bad thing. So it could be a good thing because if you didn't sleep well last night, you can catch up a little bit during the day. Or if you're in the middle of the night having a terrible night of insomnia, you can reassure yourself by saying, well, at least I can catch up a little bit tomorrow with my nap. So maybe that takes some of the pressure off, makes you less anxious. And, you know, if you're going to do something important in the afternoon, it might feel good to have that nap in your back pocket as like, well, at least I can, you know, freshen up before my big important thing in the afternoon. Where it might get people into trouble is if they nap too long or too late, then it takes away from their sleep drive. So that sleep drive we talked about earlier, it's your appetite for sleep. You save it up during the day by being awake and active. Hopefully by bedtime, you saved up enough to buy yourself a good night's sleep. But what you're doing by taking a big long nap, especially late in the day, is you're taking away some of the appetite. It's like eating multiple cupcakes right before dinner.
I think about, we have young children, when they were younger and napping all the time, the same thing held true. If the child took a nap too late in the afternoon, bedtime would be a disaster, or if the nap was too long. So we're not different from toddlers in that sense.
Yes, that's exactly right. And funny thing about babies and toddlers, especially babies, is that better naps during the day actually beget better sleep later at night. So napping too long and too late will mess up nighttime, but you do need enough napping during the day for babies and toddlers to sleep well at night. Because if they don't get their naps during the day, their fight or flight systems kick in and their adrenaline kicks in. And that can carry over into the evening and mess up bedtime. So in a way, adults are not so dissimilar where, you know, if we keep going too hard during the day without any rest, that spikes up our fight or flight systems. Basically, the message that we're sending to our bodies by hustling all day long is, oh, well, there must be a saber-toothed tiger chasing us. Otherwise, why are we not sitting down, you know, in the shade of the tree to like rest a little bit? So resting during the day, even if you don't fall asleep, is really good.
Meditation would fall in that bucket, or breath work.
Absolutely. Yes.
And so is there, in the same way, a general rule of thumb is distance between last meal and bedtime, roughly 3 hours, maybe for some a little longer, a little less. Like, is there a same like general rule of thumb for napping between nap and bedtime?
I would actually go from when you woke up. So assuming that someone has a pretty consistent rise time, and that's really the foundation of everything. If you have a wildly different rise time, bedtime every day, then there's no use talking about rules for napping because it's just all over the place anyways, except for people with shift work, but that's a special case. So for people who have a consistent rise time, I would say start your nap about 6 or 8 hours, somewhere in the 6 or 8 hour zone after you woke up for the day, and keep your nap to about 30 minutes. No more than an hour, but better yet, 30 minutes.
Got it. And so you mentioned high quality sleep. How do you define that? Is it, you know, 7 hours, 9 hours, or is it the amount of time we spend in REM or deep? Or is it more a matter of how we feel when we wake up and throughout the day, or all of the above? What's your view?
All of the above and then some. So yes, so you're right. The quality of sleep is multifaceted. It's not just one number or one thing that we can boil it down to. So first you mentioned duration. That is important. Getting enough sleep is important. And that amount can be different for different people. So, you know, you might need 8 hours. I might need 7. LeBron James needs 12, understandably, because he's, you know, just working out all day long. He's a machine and a giant, by the way. I'm like probably a third of his size and a couch potato. I'm not going to need the same amount of water as him to survive. And I don't need the same amount of sleep, right? So the duration of sleep may differ, but for most adults, from the age of 25-ish to, you know, older adults, let's say the age range of 25 to 65, it's probably going to be in the range of 7 to 9 hours. Younger adults younger than that are going to need more. And older adults older than 65 are likely to need less. So depends on your age, depends on your lifestyle and a bunch of circumstances, like your genes. So you mentioned duration. You also mentioned the amount of time that we spend in REM and deep sleep. That matters too. Like I mentioned with people with sleep apnea, they may not spend any time in deep sleep. That's really poor quality sleep. So we want about 15-ish percent of the night to be deep sleep, about 20 to 25% to be REM sleep, and the rest to be light sleep or awake, little bits of awake.
Building off that, I'll share a personal anecdote, which is still developing as it's fresh off the press here. And I'm learning more. I recently did a Pronuvo, you know, the full body scan. We're going to do a full episode on it. And it led me to see an ENT because they finding that there was maybe something around the nasal area. And so I go to the ENT and immediately he says, you must be a severe snorer. And I said, not according to my wife. My wife actually snores, not me. And he kind of chuckled and he said, you have a very deviated septum. And I said, well, that's news to me. And he said, it's so deviated that you have what we call nasal valve collapse. And I'm like, what's that?
Well,
and so he says, let's look in the mirror. And he said, breathe through your nose. So for those watching on YouTube, I'll do it. My one nostril just collapses. And he's like, you're not really a good nasal breather. And I say, that's news to me too, since I try to consciously breathe through my nose. And I said, you know, is this, I played basketball throughout my life in college. Like, I've gotten elbows everywhere. Like, was this an injury? He said, no, you're probably born with it and have had it your whole life. And so I'm like, what do I do? And he said, well, you could possibly get surgery, or you may want to try like a nasal strip or dilator to see if it works itself out. And so, of course, I want to explore this. And I've always been, I sleep fine, but I measure everything. I've always been great on REM, according to my aura, but always light on deep for the most part. So I go home, I get my nasal strips. That night, my deep goes through the roof. Usually I'm like 50 to 30 minutes. All of a sudden, it's like 2 hours.
Wow. Your brain really needed it.
And then I have the issue is the nasal strip I wore was a little too tough on my nose. It was like ripping apart the skin. So I'm like, oh, do I want to destroy my nose? I got to figure out a solution here. But to me, it was a real aha moment in that I'm like pretty good. Like, yeah, I love coffee. I drink a lot of coffee. I tend to get let down. But like, wow, like I never knew, I don't suffer from insomnia, that sleep could be this good. And the larger point I'm trying to make with apnea, breathing plays a significant role here. And if almost 70%, I've read this, statistics vary, but I've read upwards of 70 to 80% have a deviated septum. How many people are walking around like me who don't suffer from insomnia, who can fall asleep, like don't really suffer from sleep, but like never knew that sleep could be so good.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I'm glad you shared that. Yeah. Because, you know, I'm not surprised that you don't have insomnia, because your brain was probably so desperate for that extra deep sleep that why would you have trouble falling asleep, right? So that's why I always say people who are sleep deprived, whether deprived of duration or quality, are not the same people who have insomnia. Because if you truly were sleep deprived, like you were mildly probably all your life, you're not going to have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep.
Yeah. Like, wow.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. Breathing is huge in sleep. I mean, obviously, right? Like breathing is the number one thing that keeps us alive. And the number one thing that, you know, will kill us too, if we don't do it well. So, you know, anecdotally, I will share that I actually sleep in a separate room from my husband for about half of the year, because whenever we can't keep the windows open overnight, I have to sleep in a separate room, because I just feel like there's not enough fresh air. I mean, we keep the door open, like everything. We have the fan going all night, but still.
Let's go there, because my next question was air quality. Like, this is, you're building off, like, talk more about that decision and the role of air. And then that's a big one, quote unquote, sleep divorce, where you say, I'm getting out of here.
Yeah, exactly. Air quality, we know for a fact that your general neighborhood air quality matters for your sleep. Also, the air quality in your room matters for your sleep. I'm fortunate enough to live in a pretty green neighborhood, so the air quality in my environment is good. So when I'm able to keep my bedroom windows open overnight, which is during the spring and fall, then I'm able to sleep really well, even with a dog and a 200-pound husband next to me. But in the summer and winter, when we have to either have the air conditioning or the heat on, even with the fan going all night and our door open and everything, the air circulation is just not quite good enough. And I find myself dragging in the mornings and dragging during the day. Even if everything else was equal, the sleep quality is not as good. So when I sleep in a separate room by myself.
So the HVAC.
Yeah. The HVAC is not enough, apparently. I mean, it's possible that my HVAC system is not that efficient. Other people might have bigger houses or better HVACs. But I mean, I live in like a decently sized house, you know, 3-bed, 2-bath, you know, that kind of thing. But I really do find that sleeping in a separate room helps my sleep quality tremendously.
Did a humidifier help? And do humidifiers in general help people?
I think it depends on where you live. Like, I visited my best friend in Colorado recently. I had to have like 2 humidifiers going and like 5 glasses of water overnight. But I live in North Carolina and I usually don't need a humidifier. So it depends on your local situation. But yeah, back to your overall point about nasal breathing and breathing in general, you're right. It's so important. And this is actually, a PSA for people who are pregnant, which is that estrogen, which is a hormone that's increasing a lot during pregnancy, that tends to vasodilate and like cause vasodilation, and that narrows your nasal passageway. So your breathing at night is going to be worse during pregnancy. Not to mention, you have less lung capacity because the baby's pushing up against you. Your body is hotter. You have more blood volume. You're uncomfortable. You need to pee all the time. So there's a lot of reasons why people who are pregnant don't sleep as well, but the breathing is a big part of it. So I always say, if you're pregnant, make sure you get your allergies treated. You know, make sure your house is as dust-free and humidified as possible. Like, sleep on your side, nasal strips galore, because sleep is already going to be difficult when you're pregnant. The last thing you need is a stuffed up nose.
Yes. And, you know, why does it happen? You know, for me, this, I'm not pregnant, I'm a middle-aged male, but I'll often find, and I don't think I'm alone here, the nose will be fine during the day, but then when you lie down for bed, there, it just sometimes the stuffiness happens. Why is that?
Oh, that's a question for an ENT. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, aside from the nose, our prone position when we're lying down, that increases the risk of other parts of your airway being blocked. Like women with heavier chests or men with bigger necks, you know, can have their, you know, there are so many points in our airway that can collapse. And also Asian people, our orofacial structure, our bone structure, makes us more likely to have an airway collapse. So Asians are more likely to have sleep apnea. So there's just all sorts of factors that you wouldn't think about, other than being male and being middle-aged or older, or being heavier. Like, yes, these things are risk factors, but I've had, you know, Duke varsity athletes who have like 0% body fat have sleep apnea, you know, so it really could happen to anyone.
How do you think about sleep position, side or on the back?
Well, for someone who snores or might have sleep apnea or is on the way to having it, side is the way to go. Less chance for airway collapse.
And, you know, you mentioned being outdoors. Can we talk about how time in nature can impact our sleep quality?
Oh, it can impact it so much for a few good reasons. One, the most important is light exposure. So broad spectrum light exposure is the strongest and best kept secret for good quality sleep. Because what we all talk about is like how long you're asleep, how, you know, REM sleep, blah, blah, blah. But we don't talk about our circadian rhythms very much. And this is another aspect of sleep quality that I was going to get to. So this is perfect. Your circadian rhythm is your body clock. And you actually have billions of body clocks inside of you in each of your cells, organ systems, in your hormones and, you know, cognitive function. Everything in your body runs on a clock. And for everything to work well together and in sync, your master clock in your brain, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, the SCN, that has to function really well. And the way that that functions really well is by getting lots of light exposure during the day and not a lot of light exposure at night. So we evolved to have light during the day and darkness, or maybe like orange firelights at night. So the broad spectrum light that includes the blue frequency lights, that should really only happen during the day. So being outdoors helps us to get this sunlight exposure that we need. And so that actually allows us to use some of our screens at night, because the bigger the contrast between your daytime light exposure and your nighttime light exposure, the better. So even if you want to use your screens at night, it's okay as long as you got lots of light during the day outside. So that's one way that sunlight or being in nature is helpful.
And something I'll try to do at night is I'll wear, Whoop has these glasses that kind of limit like the amount of artificial light getting in, which I find to be helpful. And, you know, building off of nature and light during the day and circadian rhythms. Can we talk about daylight savings?
I hate it. I hate it so much.
And it concerns me that this is, I don't know if it, I have no idea if it actually has a chance of passing in the House, or I think it's the Senate or the House or vice versa. The fact that we're considering like going with it, you're like, this is a, like, can we talk about why it's a disaster?
Yes, we can. So we just talked about how important your circadian rhythms are. When we're misaligned from the solar time, which is, you know, the sun's path across the sky, we are worse off in every way. So that means waking up in the dark and going to bed, or at least going late, like deep into our evenings with daylight still outside. That's what happens during daylight saving time. And that's really, really bad for our circadian rhythms. And that's not only going to impact our sleep quality and quantity at night, it's going to impact our metabolism, our cognitive function, our heart health, everything. You know, all else equal, we are more likely to have cancer. We're more likely to have metabolic disorders. We're more likely to gain extra weight and have a harder time shedding it when we want to shed it, when our body clocks are misaligned from solar clocks. So, here's a great example. We know that within each time zone, the people who are on the western side of that time zone compared to people on the eastern part of the time zone, those people on the western side are more likely to have cancer.
Wow.
Within the same time zone, the sun rises later and sets later. So even just within one time zone, we get such a big effect. Imagine if we just shifted everybody over 1 hour permanently. That's terrible.
Wow. So in other words, if we were to look at a map of the United States and you take, I'll just go with Eastern, so like the easternmost part of that time zone. So perhaps it's, you know, eastern end of Massachusetts or Maine, or I guess Miami's not that far over, compared to western Pennsylvania or Ohio. There's a difference. The more east you are, the better. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So God willing, they fix this one. Every it's just a travesty.
I know.
Something else I found interesting, because I, you know, wear all my trackers, is I found that dreams, specifically nightmares, play a significant role, obviously. So one, you can wake up, but two, I've noticed I'll have sometimes my heart rate will spike in the middle of the night. And when I wake up and look at it, it will often coincide with a dream that wasn't so pleasant. And so can we talk about dreams and nightmares and what we could do to possibly mitigate them beyond, you know, eliminating trauma in our lives, which I don't think is possible, but.
Yeah. Well, you made a really good point there about the heart rate going up and the blood pressure, by the way, if you were able to measure that, blood pressure goes up during a nightmare too. Because a nightmare is really just a huge spike in our fight or flight system. It's like your brain thinks that some major threat is happening. So your body's acting as if there really is a tiger in the room. So of course, if you have a lot of nightmares or frequent nightmares, then that's going to be not so good for your heart health. You're chronically raising your blood pressure at night. You know, you don't get as much of that blood pressure dip, as I talked about earlier, that you should have. And your cortisol level goes up, your heart rate goes up. So we actually found in a separate study that amongst veterans, nightmares alone, so aside from trauma history, aside from depression, aside from how much you sleep, and if we statistically account for all of those variables, nightmares alone raises the risk of heart disease. So you're absolutely right. We do actually want to pay attention to nightmares.
You know, where I go, you always anecdotally, you hear, you know, someone passes away from a heart attack in their sleep. Where my head goes is, was this a really bad nightmare? Someone who's already at risk.
Possibly.
So something else I'm curious about, low-level noise or pleasant or music and how it affects our sleep at night. Good, bad, maybe?
I would say, okay, so we know from the research that pink noise, maybe brown noise, maybe white noise, but certainly pink noise is helpful because it masks other more startling sounds that would wake you up, like a barking dog or a slamming door or something like that. And also the frequency of the sound wave may also help to sort of sync up with our brain waves, the type of brain waves that we have when we are in a relaxation state or in a sleep state. So it's possible that something like pink noise could be helpful for sleep. And in fact, you know, for babies and kids, I pretty much just across the board recommend using some pink noise.
So what's pink? I've heard of white noise, but I haven't heard of pink noise.
Oh, okay. So white noise is random sounds, like staticky sounds that are equal in power at every frequency band. Pink noise is when there's higher power at the lower frequency bands or like middle frequency bands, but lower power in the higher frequency bands. So pink noise is like sounds a little bit fuller and deeper. And brown noise is even more power in the lower frequency band. So that sounds even lower and deeper. So in nature, wind would be white noise, for example, something like white noise. Whereas like a creek flowing would be something like brown noise or pink noise. Leaves rustling, probably more like pink noise.
Interesting. Does it make the case for living near water?
Oh, I mean, personally, I would love to. I think that would be great. There's nothing more relaxing than the ocean sound, right? That's brown noise right there. It's like the ocean coming in and out with the waves. There's nothing more soothing than that.
Agreed. So we covered a lot today. Is there anything we didn't cover that you'd like to touch on or any words of wisdom you'd like to leave our listeners before we wrap?
I would say for the general person, if we're really talking about sleep quality, I would focus less on the quantity, although if that's a problem, you got to solve that first. But I would focus more on the regularity of the timing of your sleep. Like there was just this really big study that recently got published showing that if we follow people over time, over like 18 years, it was thousands of participants, we saw that people with more regularly timed sleep lived longer, had less cancer, had less heart disease than people who had variable sleep patterns. And the sleep regularity was actually a bigger contributor, bigger predictor, at least, of someone's health down the line than sleep duration. So sleep regularity is even more important than sleep duration. So that's something we tend to overlook. Everybody's like, oh yeah, I get my, 8 hours or 7 hours. And if I don't on the weekdays, I make up for it on weekends. But yeah, you're making up for it on weekends by sleeping in by 3 hours. That's like flying yourself from New York to Los Angeles and back every weekend. You know, that's jet lag. That's really bad for your functioning on Monday and probably Tuesday. And it's bad for your long-term health. So I think the regularity of sleep is the number one thing that we don't talk about enough. That's super, super important. So I think between that and, coming back to that metaphor about sleep being your friend, this is a refrain I keep coming back to because I think this is really a good framework for how to prioritize sleep health and how to figure out what does sleep health mean to you? What works best for you? If you think about sleep as a friend, you'll be able to figure that out without necessarily trying to pigeonhole yourself by saying, oh, I should have this amount of sleep or I should do this when I get up during the night. I mean, some things work for some people and some things don't work, right? But as long as you treat sleep like a friend, you will prioritize it. You will have good boundaries, but be flexible within those boundaries. And you'll be respectful of your sleep and you'll be grateful and appreciative of your sleep. So just treat sleep like a friend and you will have a lifelong companion that really, really treats you well.
Very sage advice. Jade, thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.